With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Happy New Year! Welcome back to the Nature Jobs Podcast. I'm Julie Gould. In this episode, we're exploring two different changes in careers in science. A move from academic research to something else.
PhDs in science are happy across the board in a variety of sectors. They're enjoying their jobs, and that's data that I try to share with the trainees.
And a retirement from a long, successful career in academic science.
A lot of the people who I talk with tell me, I'm really afraid that if I close the lab, I'm just going to go home, turn on the television, sit on the couch, and pass away.
I don't know if you noticed, but the year started on a Monday. So you had a new week, a new month, and a new year all in one go. And hopefully a very refreshed you for some great adventures in science. But many of these new adventures start by taking a leap of faith. And these leaps often, although very exciting, can cause a little bit of uncertainty and worry in some, especially when it comes to leaving academic research earlier on in the career track. Because for many, often the shift is unplanned. If we look back at the 2017 Nature Graduate Student Survey, which came out at the tail end of last year, of more than 5,700 surveyed science PhD students, 75% had said that they wanted to pursue a career in academic research. But sadly, there aren't enough academic research jobs for all of those science PhDs. A 2015 analysis of the biomedical sciences estimated that for every tenure track position there was in the US, there were 6.3 PhD students being trained. But just because you might not end up as a tenure track scientist doesn't mean that you're wasting your time doing a PhD. Melanie Sinch, who's the Director of Education at the Jackson Laboratories in the US, has spent some time doing research on transferable skills and job satisfaction in science. And she published her work in PLOS One at the tail end of last year, but she discovered that actually anyone who has a PhD, whether in academia or not, is actually very satisfied with what they're doing.
Because I'm trained as a counselor, I see many trainees in counseling appointments, and they sometimes will share that personally they feel a sense of loss or a sense of guilt or a sense of not using all of their education and training for what they were ultimately engaged in training for. And what I try to do is help them to break down that myth by recognizing all that they have accomplished. And I try to help them recognize that they have so much to contribute to society, to the economy, in lots of different ways, in lots of different occupations. And typically people will start to open up and see that they do have a variety of skills, a diversity of skills that they can apply in a job that will be fulfilling. And that's the other piece that we found in my research. We found that of all of those PhDs who are employed outside of tenure-track positions, this is in our sample of just over 8,000 PhDs, 80% are satisfied with their jobs. And so people are happy, PhDs in science are happy across the board in a variety of sectors. They're enjoying their jobs. And that's data that I try to share with the trainees to encourage them to let go of that guilt.
And did you look at all into what was the, I guess, the cause or the drive behind such a high level of satisfaction?
Yes. So I asked questions in our survey about activities at work. And that's another eye-opening statistic that I can share today. Of all of the PhDs who are out in the workforce across all sectors, 75% are currently engaged in research in some way. So regardless of the type of job, 3 out of 4 trainees who are in the workforce today are conducting research, and that has led to great satisfaction. And 1 out of 3 in the group is teaching in some way. And I think that, again, crosses all different kinds of positions. So, for example, if a trainee is working in regulatory affairs, they may be teaching or training other people about regulations for bringing a drug to market. And so there are a lot of different ways in which people achieve that satisfaction.
Is that why they are not having these feelings of guilt? Because they don't feel like they are leaving behind all of their training and not using it to its full potential?
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. They're recognizing that their training was not all for naught, that they have trained indeed and are able to use their strong research skills. Another career path that several of our PhDs have moved into is consulting. And in consulting, you're given the role of researcher, really, that you have a very short period of time, typically, to conduct research, gather information, interpret data, distill information and communicate a message to your client in a very short period of time. And that is something that PhD trainees excel at.
What started off this research? Why did you decide to do this?
I actually have worked with PhDs and postdocs for about 20 years and have always heard the same kinds of questions and sentiments in my counseling appointments. And those were, I have no skills, I am no good at anything but my particular project, and I have nothing of value to offer employers in different areas, or I've been on the job market for years and I'm not securing a faculty job and I don't know what else is out there, and I don't know whether people are happy in their jobs. And so, you know, we have access to some data across the globe on where PhDs end up, but what spurred my research and conducting the survey was the questions that arose in my counseling appointments and sort of a dearth of really granular data. So more specific information on where are PhDs ending up and what are their job titles and what do they do all day at work and are they satisfied? And if they're satisfied, why are they satisfied? And so it was a pleasure to design the survey instrument and distribute that to PhDs across the globe and to collect information on where people are ending up and why they chose the careers they did.
Were there any trends that you saw that were country specific?
I would say outside of the U.S., people seemed even more focused on faculty positions. When I looked at the question around what career were you striving for at the outset of your PhD or at the beginning of your postdoctoral training? So I was struck by the number of people outside of the U.S. Proportionally who were more interested in faculty careers than others.
And was there any indication as to why?
You know, so much of our motivation, and this was borne out in the survey data, is driven by location. by geography, right? So we, in the survey, we asked about motivation for accepting positions. And the number one reason that people accepted their jobs was for intellectual challenge, which was, again, a great indicator that people are being challenged intellectually across sectors. But the second reason was for flexibility on the job. But the third top motivator was geographic location. So I think largely because so many of our PhDs ended up in the academic sector, so of the entire sample, 49% are in the academic sector, I think what happens organically is that people who are in PhD level training, people who are engaged in PhD programs or in postdoctoral training, enjoy the academic life, they enjoy the academic environment and culture, and they tend to start to build relationships, put down roots, sometimes build families, and want to stay in the regions in which they're training. And so a natural outgrowth of that in terms of career goals is then a faculty position at their university where they're training. And so that seems to be one of the driving factors is geographic location and wanting to stay in the academic environment.
Thank you very much to Melanie Sinch for sharing her research insights. And you can read more about her research in PLOS One. So from changing career track, well, to changing career track. Just because you come to the end of one part of your working life doesn't mean it needs to stop altogether. And after 35 very successful years of running the Coulter Lab at Harvard Medical School, Roberto Coulter has officially become Professor Emeritus and will, in the summer of this year, close the doors of his lab for good, coincidentally timing it with his 65th birthday. But that doesn't mean that this is the end of his involvement in science. Actually, it's very far from it.
When I arrived in 83 at Harvard Medical School, the last thing from my mind was that I would be at Harvard Medical School for 35 years. In fact, at the time when one took an assistant professorship there, the chances of getting tenure, we all knew, was very small. So I saw it as, well, I'm not so sure what I want to do for the next 3 years. So I said, wait, why not go there for a few years and then I'll figure out what I do.
If you look back at some of the stuff that your lab has produced, have there been any particular favorite pieces of research?
Just before getting tenure in the early 90s, we were looking at the dynamics of stationary phase populations. And that was such an unexpected finding for us that I still keep it as one of my absolute favorites. The whole entry into the biofilm field and being among the first to do genetics, focusing on biofilm formation. And that was really exciting because it just revealed a whole new world. And I think I'm very excited about that, primarily because of the impact it has had in so many other people being influenced by that work.
You're talking about biofilms. I mean, you very, very recently have had a lot of interesting stuff going on there, especially with the work you've done with Scott Chmielewski and your new book that you've just had published.
I'm really, really happy about that piece of work. That, of course, being a compilation of images and text that covers a very broad aspect of microbiology. I must say, not being primary research, I didn't think of it as one thing, but what a better way to close my lab than with that, it's almost like announcing that this is a new area that I probably will stay on, science communication, etc. So I think that is one of the key things.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I want to pursue, and I think it's an important role that we, as sort of more, it's called the elder statesmen of the discipline, can really provide as a wonderful contribution.
All right, so before we talk about your future plans, I'm keen to know why you've actually made the decision to close down your lab.
First of all, I think that the opportunity that I have of branching out onto other things is remarkable. I've gotten very excited, as I said, about communicating science to the public. the fact that I look back at 35 very nice years, and also the fact that I'm successful in funding, has made me think a lot about the dynamics of our discipline and the number of people that we're training. And I've trained 120 plus scientists, most of them still practicing science. Maybe a good 50 of them are holding faculty positions. And if they were to have similar paths as mine in the future, that would mean a remarkable exponential growth in the number of people trained. And I think as a consequence, I do believe that it's good to stop training people at some point so that the people one trained can go on to do their job. And so I felt it was right in that regard.
I imagine with someone who has many successfully funded projects running in their lab, it takes some time to close this all down. So what sort of planning did you have to do in order to, you know, wind down all the work that you do?
So I knew already when I did my last four-year renewal for my biofilm grant. At the time, I had three major grants going, and so I had to stagger their ending so that I could do a slow landing of fewer and fewer people in the lab, stop accepting new fellows, but still finish the project. The plan had to be set in motion. So that meant 5 years ago, I had to make the decision and know a priori when I would be accepting my last postdoc, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't the thing that I said, okay, in 6 months, everybody gets fired and I go, right?
Well, thank goodness, that would have been slightly brutal.
Exactly. So I think as a consequence, people who have worked with me and the three people who remain in my lab, I'm trying to make sure that everybody is able to land the job that they want, et cetera. So it takes time, it takes planning to do it, I think, to do it correctly.
You're very happy about the idea of retiring, and as you've mentioned, you're keen to pursue other things. There are many scientists of your generation who aren't as keen to hang up their lab coats and close down their labs. They enjoy what they do, they're successful, and they think, well, why not continue? I can carry on training scientists and create more research. What is your view on that sort of attitude to retirement?
Okay, so this is a personal perspective, but I think a lot of that view is based, and many of my colleagues admit to this, is based on the fact that science, that at the level that we practice it, so intense, it becomes a 24/7 thing. It really is all-consuming, and it does give you a great, a rush of adrenaline because you're doing really well. But it also gives you a sense of, since it's all-encompassing, many of them live and breathe science with such a passion and such a complete overtaking of their life that when it comes to being 70 years old, say, and they're saying, what should I do? The only comfort zone is that lab and that research. I think that's sort of, it's a shame because there's so much to life that one should be as varied as possible. In fact, I think science benefits from having many, many, many other interests. But I do believe that a lot of the people who I talk with tell me, I'm really afraid that if I close the lab, I'm just going to go home, turn on the television, sit in the couch and pass away, right? Because they haven't really explored many other things. So since many of the people who are in your audience are young, my strong advice or plea is that people really develop a multitude of interests. Because I think it will benefit their science right then and there, but also will make the concept of retiring a very appealing one.
How are your fellow scientists, so those your colleagues, how are they reacting to your closure?
Many people interpret my retirement, and some of them have said, as an attack on their own decision not to retire. And some people have reacted negatively, that by encouraging this, I am stymieing or in some way preventing the growth of knowledge because such great scientists are well into their 60s, 70s, 80s, right? So that get a fair amount of resistance.
So what do you say to these colleagues who aren't as accepting of your decision?
Well, I tell them that they should really think about why it is that people are not retiring and the fact that, yes, if they retire, there's going to be great science that doesn't get done, but also that might give space to the people earlier in the career to generate great science that is not being done now because there's a tightness at the top. The other thing that I say is that maybe they should think about is that concept that they have a feeling that they are irreplaceable, and I think we're all replaceable. And it gets sometimes heated, but I think we benefit from this kind of discussion.
Absolutely.
And I'm not recommending that everybody needs to retire when they reach a certain age, because everybody has to find the right time and the right reasons.
So you're going to be officially closing your doors in August 2018, a little bit later in the year. What is next for you?
I will still oversee the progress of those three people as they go on searching for their next jobs. Scott being still in the lab, and our many projects, we're hoping to begin to write another book. Who knows when that will be done. And then many things. We have an exhibit in the Harvard Museum of Natural History opening February 15th on microbial life. So I will be involved in seeing that exhibit to completion and then seeing it operating. And I'm developing a course entitled Invisible Chefs, and it's basically all about how microbes are involved in many of the foods that we eat, and that's supposed to launch in the fall. I am hoping to do many lectures over the year on science communication. You may or may not be familiar with the fact that I've been for the last year involved in the blog Small Things Considered, so I imagine my blogging frequency will increase, and I'll be training for 3 or 4 triathlons in 18, if my health stays the way it is.
Wowzers! Out of all of that, 3 or 4 triathlons. It makes me feel exhausted. Goodness! And Roberto, I wish you all the best for your future, wherever it might take you. And I hope you will keep in touch with Nature Jobs and let us know how you get on.
Julie, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
So those were the wise words of advice from future triathlete Roberto Coulter. And because Roberto mentioned his blog, Small Things Considered, we thought we'd mention that we will be looking at the value of a blog to researchers in a Nature Careers feature due out at the beginning of February. Now, along the lines of new beginnings, our first Ask the Expert question of the year comes from a master's student in India who's keen to start his scientific career abroad.
Hello, I am Rahul Hazari, and I am a master's student at Burdwan University in India. I am hoping to continue my research in epigenetics in the USA or in Germany. But due to my financial situation, I am looking for economical support for living costs and research purposes. Why do I start looking? Thank you.
To answer Rahul's question, I've asked Susan Marriott, professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas and president of Bioscience Writers, to give us an answer. So, over to you, Susan.
To answer this question, I'd like to mention that in the United States, most graduate programs in the biological sciences do provide a stipend for students who join their program. That means the stipend is available for the student, and they receive it once a month or even every couple weeks when they're paid. And it's to provide them enough money to live while they're doing their graduate work. That means it covers the cost of housing usually. It also can cover cost of food and other costs of living so that the student can focus on doing their research and completing their graduate training. This isn't just true in the United States. I think many other countries also provide similar kinds of stipends from their universities, including Germany. One thing to think about is when you're looking at graduate programs, this stipend that you will see is available can be different. So there's different amounts of money that come to students that are attending different schools or in different graduate programs. And the reason these are different usually is because of the cost of living in the city. So if it's expensive to live in a city, the school usually offers a higher amount of money. And if it's a very inexpensive place to live, sometimes it's lower cost of money or amount of money. In addition to the stipend that you get, oftentimes most graduate programs will provide health insurance that may cost no money for the trainee or some small amount of money. So really, whether you're a local resident of the country or an international student coming into a program, there's a high likelihood that you will have opportunities to get these stipends. And when you apply for your graduate training, you can look at the website of the different graduate programs and see these stipend amounts and what they cover. Be careful on, don't just look at those that offer the highest stipend, because again, it's linked to the cost of living. And so you may be at a school that has a very high stipend, but it's so expensive to live there, you'll actually have less money to live on than in a less cost of living city. So you need to compare those, and there's actually websites that will help you compare cost of living at a certain salary and see what's the best option for you.
Thank you, Rahul Hazari and Susan Marriott, for this month's Q&A. And it's your turn now. If you've got a science career-related question that you would like us to find an answer to, then send them in. You can email us at naturejobseditor@nature.com, and we will do everything we can to try and find an expert to answer your question. But sadly, that's it for our first podcast of 2018. But don't despair, because we've got so much good stuff coming up in the rest of this year, including an interview with a mama of five PhD student.
You know, having my husband being at home saying, okay, I'm on the last like milk that you have in the freezer. And I'm like, I'm coming, like I'm on the plane. It was delayed, you know, so those challenges.
And of course, don't forget that if you want to follow more of our adventures, then you can go to the Nature Jobs blog at blogs.nature.com/naturejobs. You can follow us on Twitter at Nature Jobs. Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm Julie Gould.